The question of who replaces him is a more important one, I think, for the league. My suspicion is that it'll be a media person. That's where the league is now. It's two-thirds of its revenue comes from media and sponsorships, not from tickets and beer and
You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
Brian O'Leary here with you once again. Today we have for you an interview with New York Times writer and author Ken Belson. Ken wrote a book published on October 14th, 2025. Just a few days ago, published by Grand Central Publishing. It's called Every Day is Sunday, How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL into a Cultural and Economic Juggernaut. In the interview, we talk about the book, of course, and we go off on a few tangents, things that you folks, particularly the sports-minded bent, will be interested in. It's a history of the NFL essentially since about 1993. That's where the book picks up, more or less. And it's a pretty extensive coverage of what's happened. And like I said, the main characters are Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys, Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, and Roger Goodell, commissioner of the National Football League. So it's a good interview. Spend a little more time than we had planned, but for good reason, as you'll see. I remind you folks to go to O'LearyLetter.com. That'll get you to our Substack there. And Brian D. O'Leary on Twitter, and this will be on YouTube also. So at Brian D. O'Leary on both of those, or all three of those, actually. So stay tuned for Ken Belson. Every day is Sunday. All right, with Ken Belson here. He's got a new book, Every Day is Sunday, How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL into a Cultural and Economic Juggernaut by Grand Central Publishing, published on October 14th, a few days ago. All right, so Ken, welcome. Yeah, I just wanted to get off my chest here. Late in your book, you say, you're quoted here, you write, podcasts are more compelling than sports talk radio, so let's make that happen. All right. So, first of all, main question I think that could set this whole thing up. How did you settle on the three main characters, Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, Roger Goodell, and were they named in that order specifically, or is that just a matter of language or flow?
Well, there's something of a literary answer to this, which is the law of threes. If I had five owners, and I easily could have, you'd still be reading the subtitle right now. So I picked three. That's a kind of good number. I started the book. I was thinking of sort of when does the beginning of what we think of as the modern NFL, when does it start? It started in 1993. With the labor agreement that came in that year that settled years of litigation. And you got the free agency, players finally got free agency, and the owners got a salary cap. And most importantly, and definitely underreported, was revenue sharing. That was a 50-50 split after that. And that really, from the players' perspective, that made them partners. And so we've had this labor piece which set the foundation for the big media deals, the big sponsorship deals, the big stadium deals, all the stuff that's since flowed from that. So I picked 93. So once I started with that historical sort of benchmark, I look back, well, who was doing the most work then on the owner's side? Dan Rooney, absolutely, from the Steelers, and Jerry Jones. Pat Bolin, also in Denver, was very.
So would Rooney and Bolin be those other two that you would? Possibly,
yeah,
but they're not as relevant anymore. They're now gone. So
they're now gone. Yeah, that was part of it too. So Dan Rooney, of course, came up through the 60s and the 70s, and that was really, he was still influential through the early 2000s, but had already crested. So I wanted characters that are still living and still influential to keep the book contemporary. But so Jerry was a pivotal owner. He had come in, he was heavily in debt, his team was losing a lot of money, and he was trying to find new sources of money, both in Dallas and outside. And he was the first to look at the media deals the way the NFL used to do them. They used to have CBS, and was the NFC. NBC was covering the AFC, and then you had Monday Night Football, and that was pretty much it. And Jerry said, "Well, why do we only have three bidders for three packages? Why don't we get some other bidders in here? That's just standard. Like, let's get a bidding war going." So he had already been in contact with Rupert Murdoch, and he said to Rupert, "If you come in, we'll take you seriously." And that really changed the dynamic dramatically, because Rupert said, "I don't care what it costs. I need football to make me legitimate as a network." And so he overpaid $100 million more than CBS per year, and he blew them out of the water. And suddenly the economics of the media, television media, went from let's break even, let's make some money in a good year, to this is a loss leader. And guess what? The NBA looked at that, MLB looked at that, and they said, maybe we need some more bidders. So that was Jerry Jones's big contribution then in that 93, 94 window. And then Robert comes in right then. He had been part owner of an affiliate, CBS affiliate in Boston, and he understood the media. He had connections to Mel Karmazin, other CBS officials. And so he was a real schmoozer. He knew how to get them hyped on the NFL. Of course, at this point, they knew they couldn't do without the NFL. So really, that those two guys were pivotal then, and then of course I was able to trace them all the way through the arc of the book to today.
Yeah, it's wonderful way that you do that. I wanted to talk about Jerry Jones real quick. He is maligned, to say the least, in almost all media. If you're not a Cowboys fan, and even if you are a Cowboys fan, you probably don't like Jerry Jones. I came away reading this book with an odd new respect for Jerry Jones.
Yeah, it depends on the lens you have, right? So I'm a business writer, let's just say that. So I'm looking at it from what has he done business-wise, and it's hard to argue with his success. It's a $10 billion franchise now. He made first franchise to make $1 billion in operating revenue, according to Forbes. He's printing money. I mean, the title of that chapter is "I love to stick that Cowboys peanut butter on everything." Anything that's not nailed down, he'll try and sell it. Carmen Policy is quoted in the book, the former president of the 49ers, and he said Jerry taught us how to sell. And the NFL was big when Jerry arrived, but it wasn't really big. And he is a relentless seller. There's a great quote from Robert Kraft. I talked about their different styles, and Robert was talking about Jerry's sort of unflappable spirit for new ventures, and he said he could charm a dog off a meat truck. It's that's who Jerry is. He lives out there. He's a salesman. He probably sells too much, and his methodology is certainly rubbed the owners the wrong way at times. But he wants to make money. His son, interestingly, because I've often thought, like, how much is enough, right? You already got $10 billion. Do you need 10 more, 10 billion more? And his son was quoted as saying, "It's not the money, it's the chase." And that's who Jerry is. He is a charmer. He can't stop. He can't help himself. In contrast, Robert Kraft is very wealthy also and very successful, but it's more of a diplomat. He's more about how do we take all these ideas and have a win-win-win solution to where everybody walks away with something. And that's more of Robert's skill.
Yeah, and you mentioned a lot of, you don't mention every single owner that's been in the game for years, but you have a sounds like you have a profound respect for the what I'll call the old guard, the Rooneys, the Mike Brown, Al Davis to some degree, the Halas family, the Rooneys, of course, the Maras. And these guys, Jones and Kraft, came in and upset the apple cart to a large degree. And maybe Kraft not so much, because maybe we can get into this. The way Kraft acquired the Patriots, I went to school in Boston, and I was aware of a lot of the things, like how Kraft acquired the team, but the brilliance of his strategy. Because you got to think back in the mid 90s, he had acquired the team through a lot of these. Well, we'll get to that in a second, but he was about to move the team twice. He wanted to move to a stadium in South Boston. The neighbors went apoplectic. Well, they probably should have, because now, like, all the South Boston neighborhood is no longer the South Boston people, whatever. But, and then he had a deal to go to Hartford. But the way he acquired the Patriots was he acquired all the parking around it, around Foxborough Stadium, which is probably one of the worst locations in sports for a stadium. But that being said, he acquired all the land around it. And when the owner, what is it, James Orthwine out of St. Louis, Bush family heir, when he tried to move the team to St. Louis before the Rams moved, Kraft was like, no, sorry, buddy, you owe rent until 2021. And so
2001. Yeah.
Yeah. Or 2001. Sorry. Yeah. Right. He had him over a barrel, and it would have cost him, you know, more than probably the franchise in paying rent in an empty stadium. So Kraft put together a deal. And that was, I thought, one of the most brilliant sports business moves of all time.
Yeah. It shows, I mean, first of all, Kraft was in it for the long term, right? Yeah. The Sullivan family was always on its, was the worst run franchise. As you said, the stadium was terrible. The location was terrible. The Sullivans were always broke. They were fighting with each other. And then Victor Kiam comes in, the old Remington Razor guy, he was not a local, and really made a hash of the whole thing. But as you said, Robert was smart. He bought the land first and the parking revenue. So now there was one leg of the financial stool was knocked out from the owner. And then eventually the stadium was up. The Sullivans couldn't afford the stadium anymore, so they put that up for sale. So then he bought that. And by the time Victor Kiam comes in, all he's got is the team. He's got tickets, basically. He doesn't have the hot dogs and beer. He doesn't have the parking. And he has the whatever the shared revenue was from the league. So he basically, and he had this lease that that obligated him to be the primary tenant through the end of the century. So when Victor Kiam yells uncle and Orthwein comes in, he thinks, well, I'll get the team and move it to St. Louis. The same issue. Can't leave. He didn't want to have a lawsuit with Kraft, and eventually he sold. So Kraft was very deliberate. That was that was about a 7 or an 8 year process. That's what I mean by long game. And you know, he wasn't leaving Boston. You talked about the sweetheart deal in Hartford. And that really was a sweetheart deal. I mean, it was unbelievable how the state of Connecticut was willing to give him. But ultimately, he's a Boston guy, and I think he wanted to stay. He also had a deal dangled from Providence. There was that South Boston thing that was handled poorly, and there was a lot of politics involved in it, local politics. So,
and Boston Irish.
Yeah, imagine that. you know, it's funny because he grew up in Boston, but he's still considered to the old Boston establishment to be a newcomer, you know, and so there's a lot of jealousy there and God knows what else. But he got the stadium built, and look, they won 6 titles. You can't compete with success. The other thing, he was interesting, we're talking about real estate. When he built the stadium in Foxborough, the new stadium in Foxborough, he put Patriot Place around it. And that was fairly novel to say, you know what, who else is going to Foxborough? Let's build movie theater, a restaurant, shopping, and you know, medical facilities, and really turn it into something and use the power of the Patriots brand for real estate. And it's worth noting for your listeners, that's the revenue that is not shared amongst the other 31 owners. So Robert realizes, I got this asset. I only use it 12 times a year, and then you know, some other events, concerts. But boy, I could use the Patriots brand to make a lot more money. And Jerry Jones is taking and run with that. New stadiums coming in Cleveland, eventually Nashville. They're all doing the same thing now.
Mm-hmm. And it's mushroomed into other sports too. I mean, even the Red Sox, they've bought and developed all around Fenway Park and inside Fenway Park. The Braves are the case in the big leagues for doing a similar thing in their area. Yeah.
Well, in San Francisco, the Giants, all that real estate across McCovey Cove, super valuable. Visa put its headquarters there. Again, that's not shared revenue. The Giants owners are a lot wealthier, and private equity now sees teams partly as a vehicle for real estate and other things. So, yeah, there's people are always finding new ways to mint sports franchises.
Like to stick on the Patriots here for a second. You mentioned that during that whole time where, Parcells left under really horrible terms. I was there. They had gone to the Super Bowl, were in the Super Bowl, and everybody knew he was leaving. What was going to happen to the franchise after that? They ended up hiring Pete Carroll, former head coach of the Jets, who's turned into a success. Well, maybe this year not with the Raiders, but I mean, oh, great football coach. But he gets fired after a couple of years. And then you have this situation with the New York Jets. You talk about it a little bit in the book, and I'm always curious about it, about this, because I'm wondering if you have any insight or allowed to tell it in your insight. Because the story I've heard is that you've seen Bill Belichick interviewed several times about this, and he's like, the ownership was in flux. You had Leon Hess, who you mentioned several times in the book, and then it the there's. I don't even know what the situation was. They didn't know who the owner or the heirs or were going to be. This ownership situation was in flux. So Belichick sees this. He said, this is his story anyway. He says that I can't do this because it's just so crazy. He writes his resignation letter literally on a napkin. I resign as HC of the NYJ, and it's over. And then Kraft signs him a couple days later. Now, my question here is, number one, is that true with the ownership situation? I imagine it is. But two, was there any tampering going on behind the scenes with the Patriots and Belichick or Belichick's camp?
Yeah, it's good questions. The issue with Leon Hess is real. The team was going to be put up for sale. His estate was selling it. Who knows whether the new owner, whoever that was, turned out to be Woody Johnson, would want Belichick. If you're a head coach and a new owner comes in, the new owner might say, "I want my own people."
Because Parcells was still in charge of the organization on the football operations side, and he was running that.
Yeah, but it's perfectly understandable for a new owner to come in and clean house. I could see it from that perspective why Belichick wouldn't want to wait around to find out. He might end up being a lame duck coach after one season. Whether he was tampered with, I don't have that specific evidence, but I find it hard to believe that somebody who at that point wasn't very old, I think he was in his 40s, would simply quit without another job on the horizon. It was January. Beginning of January of 2000 that he did that. I can't believe he didn't know there were openings in a handful of markets. He already had a relationship with Robert Kraft because he was coaching when Parcells was up in New England, and Kraft liked him. So whether there was explicit conversations about this, I don't know. The Jets and Patriots ended up getting in a fight that landed in Paul Tagliabue's office. And there was compensatory draft picks given to the Jets. But as Steve Gutman, the team president, is quoted in the book, he said, "But boy, they got the coach that beat us like high school kids for the next 20 years." So in the end, the Jets really got the short end of that. Belichick, I guess he was right in the sense that he didn't want to stick around and find out what Woody Johnson would have in mind for him. And it turned out to be a good fit for the Patriots.
Yeah, and you mentioned Tagliabue, and this dovetails a little bit what's going on with Belichick now at North Carolina. You mentioned that Tagliabue said to these owners who are considering hiring him to stay away from Belichick. I'm wondering why that was. Why was he so toxic then? He had a pretty successful run with the Browns, and I would say only in '95 with the Browns, the only reason that thing went sideways or in the toilet was because of Modell announcing the move to Baltimore during the season. And there's a documentary, NFL or NFL Films or ESPN put out, Cleveland 95, I think, and you can find out all about that. But why did Tagliabue tell folks to stay away from Belichick?
I think Belichick was a complicated and taciturn guy. We know that now from watching him all these years. I think he was that way then. I don't know whether he was basically saying don't hire the guy, but he was saying, tread carefully, I think, was probably more his message. The Modell thing was interesting because Modell actually didn't want to announce it. He wanted to keep it a secret, which in some ways was worse. It was reminiscent of the Baltimore Colts pulling up the Mayflower vans to Memorial Stadium back in the 80s. And but the Baltimore media sniffed it out because it's on their end, because the stadium they had purpose built was going to have a new tenant. And that's how it got out. It didn't come out from Cleveland, and it certainly didn't come out from Modell. And there were death threats. He had to leave town. His lawyer, Jim Bailey, who I spoke to for the book, they had to go back with bodyguards. It was an ugly, ugly situation. That was a terrible environment to play football that last season, especially the last half of that season. Fans were in revolt. Garbage was on the field. He suffered, but he did make the playoffs. I believe it was the year before. I wouldn't say he was super successful, but he wasn't a bad coach. But I think he was a complicated coach. And, Robert Kraft, produced that Dynasty documentary two years ago. And, Belichick sat for it, but he did not change his image. He still looked like Darth Vader on camera. And, I'm sure that's partly who he is, mainly who he is.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I guess with that, Commissioner Tagler begets Roger Goodell, who's been there, since 2006 in charge of the NFL. This is an interesting character. I didn't know a ton about Goodell's background. He had a mission from childhood to become the NFL commissioner. And this could be one of those lessons for young folks who are like, I want to do this and I'm going to do it. And my question about Goodell is, his success or his rise to becoming the commissioner anything other than just pure unfettered ambition? Or my sense is he has just a tremendous love for the National Football League. But as I got from a lot of these different owners and different, people that work within the league and the TV, they don't necessarily have a fondness for the game of football as much as some of these coaches, say, perhaps, or the old guard, Rooney's, Mara's, et cetera, Mike Brown, Al Davis, et cetera. But tell me a little more about Goodell's path.
Sure. Well, I titled the chapter "Senator's Son." He was the third of five sons of a senator, a U.S. senator who took Robert Kennedy's spot here in New York. He was a congressman before that, and he has that sort of political sensibility. I don't mean left or right. I just mean he knows how to operate politically. And that is something he absorbed from his dad. As a kid, he worked on his father's campaigns, even as a young kid. And so he's kind of a natural politician in that sense. And he got out of college, or is getting out of college his senior year. And he wrote to his dad and he says, "Dad, this is my ambition. I want to be commissioner of the NFL. I think of all the job searches you could do, that's a pretty narrow one. There's only one of one. So, he wrote, famously wrote lots of letters to all the teams and eventually gets noticed by the headquarters. They bring him in, and he was a grunt. He worked his way up. By the 90s, by the time Tagliabue is there, he's getting more tasks. Tagliabue is sort of, and his deputy, Neil Austrian, the league president, is now giving him bigger tasks. Go to Europe. We're going to host a game in Berlin after the fall of the Berlin Wall. We need you to help with the logistics. He's now helping owners get new stadiums, which turned out to be a very powerful thing to do because you're helping the people who are ultimately going to hire you. He was a real go-getter. I spoke to quite a few people who worked at the NFL then, and some people felt like he was too nakedly ambitious, too much of a social climber. There was a comment in the book that, at the owners' meetings, the quarterly meetings, we'd go out to dinner, the staff would go out to dinner, and we'd come back to the hotel, and Roger would be getting out of a limo with an owner. He knew where he was going, and he was going to get there. Having said all that, when I asked Tagliabue about it, he says, "Why should I complain? He did everything we asked him to do." So good on him for working hard and trying to solve problems. So, that's what I mean. He was nakedly ambitious, but he succeeded and got up to the top of the mountain, so to
I
speak.
see him in the mold a bit of David Stern, where David Stern was very good for the brand, very good for the NBA, and his successor, Adam Silver, is just it's just not. And they made money. I think a lot of these leagues making money maybe off the coattails of the NFL and what Tagliabue and Goodell put in place. But what do you? Goodell's 65 or turning 65 this year, I think. I would guess they're going to extend him the contract for $70 million plus a year, probably again. But where do you see the future of the NFL leadership, commissionership after Goodell leaves? Is there anybody, or is this going to be a vacuum like it was in the NBA? Where, I mean, Silver is. Say what you want, he's serviceable, but the NBA just isn't what it was in the 80s and 90s under Stern. It's just not.
No, that was definitely a sort of glamour period. You had Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, and of course,
A
then it
lot of
became Michael
factors for
Jordan.
sure.
Yeah, I mean, those players were, they were unicorns. And the 2000s, to not get too far down the rabbit hole in the NBA, but you had a labor short stoppage in '99. You had a truncated season. They've had other problems, some of which David oversaw. But in any event, Roger has told his friends at times, "I want to step back." But the reality is, he didn't know what else he wants to do. This was the one job he wanted. He's been at the NFL for 45 years. He's very good at it. He has a very unique resume, and he has told friends, "I can't step down because I can't find anybody to replace me." Some of his friends thinks that's kind of nonsense. He wants to stay. He likes it. He's still relatively healthy. He's had some back surgery, but he's still very influential. He schmoozes with all the media people. I think he'll get through the next labor deal, which runs out in 2030, after the 2030 season. So let's see, it's another half decade. And then from that flows the next set of media deals. They may opt out early, but so I think once he puts that those two things to bed, he'll be what, 70, be in his early 70s. He might decide that's been enough. Maybe I'll go hang out with my kids or spend more time in Maine or wherever he has his homes, do some skiing. But yeah, he likes what he does. And the question of who replaces him is a more important one, I think, for the league. My suspicion is that it'll be a media person. That's where the league is now. It's two-thirds of its revenue comes from media and sponsorships, not from tickets and beer and parking and all that other stuff. That's a much smaller piece. So they're going to want somebody who can steer the league, through that universe. And of course, in the midst of all this, we're getting the fracturing of the media universe. Cable TV is dying. We're getting more streaming. How do you add streaming without, forcing fans to pay $1,000 to watch all the games?
And you talk about that last chapter of the book. It's like, where do we go from here? It's a real tough thing because they've squeezed, I think I quoted or mentioned something about squeezing every penny out of the fans. And I used to like to go to NFL games, but with the advent of StubHub, which makes it a lot easier to buy a ticket, it's also more expensive than going and going to the site and maybe scalping a ticket for $3 or for free or whatever it might be, depending on the game. And it's also such a big hassle to go to an NFL game or a big league baseball game or whatever. It's just more of a hassle these days, and it's more expensive. And compared to the 1980s, you can watch any game you want really on television or your device, really. Now, I think since we're talking about the tech and all that stuff. So it's a much different game.
Yeah, Roger likes to say that 97% of NFL fans never go to a game. And so I always think it's a little bit of lip service when he says the fans are our most important constituents. Come on. The most important constituents are the 32 owners who decide what you should be doing and how much you're going to be paid for it. But I mean, yes, fans are important, but in his mind, fans are TV viewers. And the guys who want to tailgate, good on them. I think I write a line in the book that, the fans in the stadium now are essentially props, for TV broadcasts. And, we saw it even during COVID when there were no fans. People still watched. Did they really need fans waving terrible towels? Maybe not. People still tuned in with the cardboard cutouts of fans there. They had what, the Super Bowl in Tampa that year, that was like half the seats were empty. People will watch football because it's a compelling game. It's presented in a very interesting way. All the high definition cameras and the slow motion and the strategy of it. It's still a compelling game. It's a violent game. Some people enjoy that too. There's a lot of character to the game that I think is sells itself, I guess.
Yeah, do you have a few more minutes? Or I got a question that comes up throughout the book and really toward the end too, in particular. It's the gambling side. How I was not aware that Jones and Kraft had bought in on a couple of these gambling sites before it was even legal for any sports book, but they saw the writing on the wall, it sounds like. And now the NFL, like all these leagues, are in bed with gambling, sports books, online sports books and stuff. And you just saw news of the Cleveland Indians guy, Class A. He got banned for lifetime for betting on games. There's not it hasn't been out if he threw games or not. Imagine he did, but And I went to Boston College, so if you're familiar with the stories there, that was, there's some, it bothers me to see gambling so intermixed with sports, and almost it was like every, yeah, people did it. People do it. People bet on games. People had a bookie. You could in Oregon, I don't, when you said you lived in Oregon for a while, I don't know if they had sports action then, but people loved doing sports action. It was the sports book that you could buy through the lottery. However, the NFL was never going to come to Portland or Oregon, even, for the Raiders or the Seahawks or whoever wanted to relocate, as long as they had gambling. And now gambling is okay. And I fear for the future of the league and the integrity of the league with the gambling. I don't think in the book you make any statement. Would you like to make any statement on what you see there with the gambling?
Yeah, it's well, two things. One is the NFL is not the only league that's struggled with this contradiction of, doing an about face. I mean, they were petitioning courts to not overturn or to not allow a sports book gambling outside of Las Vegas. And then the minute the Supreme Court threw it out, they were in business. So, is the NFL any different than the NBA or Major League Baseball? No, not in that sense. But, the NFL is the most gambled on sport. So they do t take sort of outsized attention. It's worth saying that they make their money now from sponsorships. You can go to a DraftKings lounge in the Commander Stadium. They are making money from the gambling companies, but not on the gambling itself. They have two sources of revenue. One is the sponsorships, and the other is selling the NFL game data to the various books. And that's really where they make, frankly, most of their money. So, are they promoting gambling by running the ads? Well, sure. Look, there are no cigarette ads in stadiums anymore because people deemed we shouldn't be promoting cigarettes. For a long time, there were no hard liquor ads in many stadiums. They've now decided, people drink Captain Morgan's rum. We can take money from Captain Morgan. I think for the integrity of the game, and you brought up baseball in particular, this case with the Cleveland Guardians, it is problematic. I think that's a, I learned this as a business reporter covering markets and companies. It can take a lifetime to build up trust. You can lose it in an instance. And the minute that fans think that the fix is in, they're going to be pissed. And now they have money running on it. We're not just talking about, I don't trust, like there's a whole meme now on the social on social media about whether the refs treat the Kansas City Chiefs differently. And AI generated pictures of Patrick Mahomes handing cash to a referee and all that. It's corrosive. And it also changes, I think gambling really changes the way people watch sports. Again, this is not just an NFL thing, but we went from the days, probably you and I, roughly the same age, sitting down with your dad with a clicker, maybe a can of beer, you had your jersey on, and you watched 3 hours. You watched a drama, basically. You might have thrown some things at the TV too, depending on who you're rooting for.
I call it reality television for men, the NFL.
Yes,
Reality television
exactly.
for men.
Yeah. And then there were highlights, and then there was ESPN and SportsCenter, and then it got broken up into smaller and smaller pieces. And then you had fantasy football. So now you're either rooting for a tight end on a team you could care less about because he's on your roster. Well, then you add money to it, and it's a very it really amplifies the tension, sometimes in a good way, but most often you're not going to win. So I mean, look, the book always wins. The sports book's going to win, so more chances than not. So now you got people pissed at the NFL, or you got pissed at a player or a team. I think that's really sort of damaging. Look, there's always been people playing, but now you're playing on your cell phone. You can bet during the game. You can bet in the stadium. It wasn't just going down to the corner or calling somebody and put a bet down. Now it's instantaneous. There's this dopamine effect that people have that's kind of distorting their kind of sense of proportion. And I think that's dangerous. Again, it's not just an NFL issue. They didn't create this, but they are partly making money off it.
Yeah, I'm not a Puritan when it comes to gambling, but I mean in its time and space, and I really think around sports when the leagues get involved or in bed, it's like, man, it is a slippery slope. And I understand that they're making money and they're keeping it at arm's length to some degree, but I just wonder, in the future, the economy gets turns south or whatever, and we're still in this system and the players aren't getting paid as much, or labor strife hits and like, all right, well, we can make a little money here. That's what I wonder. I worry about the worst case scenario, really. And it's not like the guys going to Vegas for a weekend and sitting around the blackjack table. That's a whole different animal in itself. But when you bring the games themselves that are, you can do it. I mean, Shohei Ohtani, look, like, we don't know what's going on with him. You can speculate, but this is strange, and it's a cloud.
Well, then add this. I read a headline that the NCAA was going to allow athletes to bet on football. Well, just do the math. A senior at name the university, I'm betting. I'm assuming some teammates of his are now in the NFL. What's to say they just chat on the phone about so and so's injury on some pro team?
Oh yeah, I mean, but this has happened. This has happened. I know a lot of folks that have, when gambling was illegal, so called, that ha it happened. But it was they were more discretionary about it, and they wouldn't. Well, not to say not everybody, but putting the integrity on the line so out front. Anyway, that's just maybe a perhaps a peeve of mine. One more. I guess comment about the book that I really enjoyed. I don't know if there's a question here necessarily, but the stadium relocate or team relocation. So you go through the whole 90s relocation bonanza where all these teams were moving. And curiously, you didn't mention Seattle almost moving to LA, but we'll leave that be. You could have written an 800-page book, but the explanation of what went down in the two LA potential LA stadium things, I could never figure that out just by reading the news. I'm like, what in the world is going on? So in this book, I would just congratulate you for, ferreting that out and like, all right, well, what some people were pissed, some people weren't, and it ultimately turned out really well for the NFL. Mostly good for all the teams involved, which I was surprised about. The Raiders wanted to go back to LA really and share it with the Chargers, but then the Rams, threw their wrinkle. But then the Raiders now have Vegas to themselves and a Super Bowl and all this stuff. And the LA teams seem to be doing great, and that stadium is world class.
Yeah, I think that so we could circle back to Jerry Jones for a minute. I remember sitting in his office in guess it was in 2015, like at beginning of 2015, and it was still a year away from that vote they had about which team, the Rams or the Chargers Raiders, would get the LA market. And Jerry said, you know, we got to make a splash. We only have one bite at this apple. If we're going to go back to the media capital of the world, the entertainment capital of the world, we need to come in, you know. We need to announce ourselves. We want to be like the Lakers, you know, with Jack Nicholson sitting courtside. We don't want to just have a stadium. Like, we don't, you know, I mean, the Coliseum's lovely. It's a nice relic, but that's not the future, right? That's old time. And so, you know, look,
100 years old or more.
yeah, it's crumbling basically. So, you know, but then you look at the contestants, if you will. Stan Kroenke's got, I think he was the second wealthiest owner at that point, after Paul Allen. He's a real estate man. He bought the 300 acres next to the Forum, the LA Forum. You know, he thinks big. He thinks that, and he was going to build not just the stadium, but NFL Network Studios. You know, there was going to be real estate around there. Inglewood's close to the airport. And then you got Dean Spanos and Mark Davis, basically don't have a ton of money, and don't frankly have a big vision. They brought in Bob Iger from Disney as an equity partner to kind of jazz it up. But they were going to be located in Carson, 20 more miles down 405. That's not a splash. That's just a stadium and some available land.
It's like the Chargers playing at that soccer stadium they played in for a few years.
Exactly. So I think, you know, Jerry was really the leader behind pushing the Rams. There was another Jerry Richardson, former owner of the Carolina Panthers, and he was banging the drum on the dual side, on the Raiders Chargers side, because he said, look, we got to solve two stadium problems at once. Both were playing in terrible places in San Diego and Oakland, concrete stadiums built in the 60s. If we move them down there, we solve two problems at once. They get a new home, you know, and this obviously Jets Giants share a stadium. That wouldn't be unheard of. But, you know, it really didn't have the glitz. And that meeting that you're referring to in Houston in 2016, going into it, Jerry Richardson felt like he had enough votes. You need 24 out of 32 to pass anything. And Jerry was very influential. He had a small like subcommittee that was scouting both stadiums. Robert Kraft was on that, and they voted for the dual solution, the Raiders Chargers option. And then Jerry Jones comes in, and he is lobbying hard. And some of those owners who were on the dual side switched. They saw, you know what? Look, this is big money. We're going to come into LA. We want to have a Super Bowl. This was near the airport. You know, you have views of the ocean, all the bells and whistles. And one of the key votes or voices in that room was Paul Allen. How you referenced the Seahawks. Paul almost never came to owners' meetings, but Roger Goodell called him and says, "You got to show up to this one." And he flew in, and he was like the Oracle. You know, John Houseman. You know, when so and so speaks, when E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen. And several owners said that when Paul said, "Oh, this is the L.A. one, the Rams makes the most sense." People were like, "Okay, Paul Allen says it. I'm going with Paul Allen." And so he helped in his own quiet way swing a lot of votes over. And at the end of that meeting, and this is one of the joys of the book. You know, I reported on the league for about a dozen years. There's so much stuff in my notebooks that I just never put in the New York Times stories. There's just no space for them. But that meeting, Jerry Jones comes out into the lobby, and the media is all there, and the lights pop on, and he's a pig in a poke. He's standing there grinning ear to ear, and he's got that twinkle. And you know, his guy won, Stan Kroenke. I backed that horse, and that's the one. So I'm standing right behind him, and the lights are coming in, and he's answering questions. And I look down at Jerry, his right arm's down here. He's got a big old tumbler of scotch, and it's about this big. And he's having a good time. And that's Jerry. He's the salesman. He's in it for the thrill, and he got his catch that day.
Yeah, that's great. And then that was pretty much the last we heard of Jerry Richardson. He went on to try and sell the team, eventually did before, not before getting blackballed from the league. Fine on his way out the door. Sad end to a great football career for Jerry Richardson, but you know, he made his own bed there a little bit himself. All right. Well, gosh, Ken, this has been a wonderful conversation. I appreciate it. Great luck with the book. Once again, it's Every Day is Sunday, How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL into a Cultural and Economic Juggernaut, Grand Central Publishing. October 14th, 2025. And it is a cultural and economic juggernaut. No doubt about it. So, any last words, Ken?
No, thank you, Brian. It's a great conversation. I appreciate you having me on. And this is an endless source of conversation. I've been on airplanes with people. I've seen people overseas. The NFL is a 365 organization.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate it, Ken. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to the Brian D. O'Leary Show. Once again, you can find me on Twitter X at Brian D. O'Leary. Same thing goes for YouTube and Substack. And you can get our regular emails, posts, columns, podcasts, video podcasts, all that, if you go to O'LearyLetter.com, and we'll have that all in the show notes for you. Once again, thanks for tuning in, folks, and we'll see you next time.
Show your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.